So this is almost an 180 degree switch from we had the construction of the national highway system and the dominant position of television in everybody's lives. It's kind of led to an individualization in the mindset, so that everybody's responsible for themselves, and you know that's as far as it goes. And it looks like this shock may actually help rebuild community and rebuild the idea that we all actually have to work together. You could, because if you don't have large families, you could coordinate several farms in the area and focus on each farm producing a certain good for the community and get together with the prices and such and the profits.
Yes, it's interesting because if handled correctly, this could lead to actually a better quality living environment for most of us. A lot of people nowadays kind of look upon the past and wistfully or wander around wondering what's missing from their life. And generally what's missing is that quality of life, that socialization, the things that we had before society was atomized.
It's kind of ironic. The countries and the nations that are looked at as backward or kind of behind the curve are actually going to be able to react to the situation much better than the advanced societies or the highly industrialized societies, because they've got a greater contact with the land and they're more based on community than the industrial societies are.
So long as they don't have a population problem. You know, when we're talking about India, they're going to have big problems because they have no energy base of their own. They have very little energy. They have some coal, but it's very low quality coal. They're dependent on imports for virtually all of their energy needs. And, you know, they have a tremendous population, which has been in part provided for through international grain and agricultural production. And although I haven't looked into the case of India too specifically, I would suspect that they could go back to some of their older ways of providing energy and meet, or providing food, that is, food energy, and meet some of their own needs in that way. As I say, I haven't looked at that specific situation there.
So you mentioned earlier a lot of the things we can do here to actually make this a positive situation in the long run. Let's take a look at the other possibility. Do you see our government making any preparations for the possibility that society doesn't react well to the fact that we're not living in a growth economy anymore, and we start to really face serious hardship in the security area and policing? I mean, does it seem like they're making any preparations?
Oh, yes. It could easily be argued that much of the legislation which has come down the pike, especially since 9/11, will actually make it much easier for them to repress any sort of dissatisfied public which may arise due to energy depletion. Very, very troublesome. When you start looking at some of the repressive, restrictive legislation they have passed, limiting our rights in this country, you begin to get very worried about it.
That they see something coming that they're not making public once again, but they're planning for the future because they can see what the future holds, and that some people may not be happy with the fact that their options are even more limited than they are today.
Yes. It has been pointed out that every major civilization prior to the Industrial Revolution, including the United States prior to the Industrial Revolution, met its energy needs through slavery. And there have been some who have suggested that with the large amount of private debt, consumer debt in this country, that the move to tougher bankruptcy laws and that sort of thing could be a forerunner to work camps or indentured servitude in this country where people who are in debt would have to work off their debt.
And especially, I mean, a lot of farmers, a lot of family farmers especially, are really fighting debt at this point right now. So you would naturally think that if we transition to a local agricultural economy, they would be sitting well, but it may turn out that there may be some plans for land acquisition by other wealthier folks to take control of that land and, like you said, turn it into a situation where it's an indentured servitude.
Yes, the situation here right now, for one thing, in the past decade, and even more so in the last few years, a lot of the wealth of this country has been moved offshore, and there have been terrific amounts of money, trillions of dollars lost from the defense budget that were just lost. You know, they say they have no clue what happened to them. Hundreds of billions of dollars from HUD and various other government operations. There's been a big flight of the wealth of this country offshore. And on the other hand, you have the housing bubble, which could bust at any time. Housing rates are greatly inflated. Real estate rates are up way above what they should be. People who hold mortgages could someday find themselves in a position where their property values are suddenly worthless or next to worthless, but they have a tremendous debt that they have to pay off with devaluated money.
And with the new bankruptcy law, like you mentioned earlier, there's no way out of it at this point.
Yeah.
It's like once you owe the debt, you owe the debt, and you're going to pay it off, you know, until the day you die.
Yeah. And then that wealth that has been moved offshore, of course, will walk back into the country
for the bargains
and pick up all of this property for, you know, pennies on the dollar.
It's fundraising week. Let's get the community involved. The number here is 454-7762 if you want to call in and ask Dale any questions, and we'll keep talking until we get some callers. Where were we? We were talking about the situation with the housing. And the housing situation is also very tied into the strength of the dollar. So we were talking earlier about China and other countries calling in their markers, which would deflate the dollar, which would really kind of accelerate the problem with housing.
Oh, yeah. Yes, they. My editor, Michael Rupert at From the Wilderness, he has voiced his opinion that China won't call in its marker until the housing market begins to collapse. I'm not quite sure why he feels that the housing market will collapse first, but.
And aside from, I believe it's. Medical and service economy, the housing market's the only thing really keeping the American economy afloat right now.
Everybody is basically bankrolling their personal debt with second and even third mortgages. And, you know, Bush, after 2001, after 9/11, he said, you know, go out and spend to keep the economy going. Well, the way that people have done that is by racking up debt. And they've managed to finance those debts so far with their real estate holdings. Right now, you know, we're worked up into a terrible state of personal debt, and now they've come through with this repressive bankruptcy legislation so that there isn't going to be any way out of that debt other than to basically lose your homes and go to work for somebody.
And I believe we have a caller. We have Peter. Peter?
Hi, yes. So, thank you very much for having this really important conversation. I have one comment and then a question. You know, one reason it's hard to see the peak is that when you're on top of it, the perspective, you know, so to speak, it's hard to actually appreciate where you are. But the other thing is that in the distribution of things, be it life, you know, bacteria to whales, or be it meteorites from sand grains to comets, you know, there's a distribution of things. And yes, we've got rid of all the big oil. We're into the mega field or the big field. But there are these intermediate and small fields that add an uncertain amount of oil that can kind of delay the onset of this peak. The trouble is, we can't afford to burn it. Our carbon dioxide levels are already 30% higher than the warmest time at the last interglacial. We're facing large climatic changes, and we cannot bear the moral responsibility for burning the remaining oil, regardless of whether we can find it or not. And that's basically what I wanted to say. There's a real problem that we've set off in the environment, on top of which we have our monetary system, which is a classic pyramidal system. It depends on having people at the bottom who may very well drop into wage slavery, may very well drop into slavery or indentured servitude. I see it, and thank you very much for having this important conversation.
Thank you very much. That was a very good comment there. It brought up the problem of global warming, which is the flip side of the oil problem. All of this oil is basically carbon that at one time was in our atmosphere. It's been locked up by the planet through natural processes and at depth, and we've brought it back up to the surface, burned it, and sent it back off into the atmosphere again. I've written a series of articles looking at global warming, and at the tail end of the articles, it looks at the possible implications of peak oil on global warming. And I'm afraid that what I see isn't too good, because one of the easy outs for the United States and China and many other countries is to turn back to coal for a lot of their energy needs. In the United States, there are right now at least, the last estimate I heard was 100 new coal-burning plants being projected in the years to come. They're keeping it quite hush-hush. They will probably be required to implement carbon sequestration technology to help keep down on the carbon dioxide emissions. But I have heard no talk about limiting the other pollutants from coal. Coal puts a lot of different pollutants, mostly particulates, in the air. That is, you know, little bits of this or that. And a problem that we're now starting to discuss openly is kind of the flip of global warming is global dimming, where they have noticed over the last decade or so that the amount of sunlight reaching the surface of the earth has actually decreased, and this has offset some of the warming due to the greenhouse gas production. And as near as they can figure it right now, they're not 100% sure, but the studies seem to indicate that this global dimming is due to particulate pollutants. So a decrease in oil production and natural gas production could lead to increased coal burning, which could lead to an increase in particulates and not quite as substantial, but also an increase in carbon dioxide emissions. But it would mask global warming due to the particulates until coal peaked. And an associate of mine working with the Department of Energy on his own time, worked up a study of U.S. coal reserves and when they would peak, and his projection was about 2032. So, you know, we would move along with coal until about 2032, and then our coal burning would start to decrease, particulate rain out of the atmosphere a lot quicker than carbon dioxide. So after coal burning began to decrease, the particulates would rain out of the atmosphere, and we would suddenly be hit with global warming at twice the rate we have currently.
So right now we actually have the cover of the carbon dioxide, but it's being shielded. I mean, the sunlight reaching the Earth originally is diminished because of the particulates, and that will actually, that situation will increase. But then once the particulates come out, it's kind of like opening up the window to the incoming sunlight, which will then not be able to get back out because we've also built up the carbon dioxide level.
Yeah.
That's optimistic. So how do you think the U.S. citizens should change their expectations or alter their expectations or viewpoints to get through this? I mean, what do you think, just psychologically, how they should start to think about life, so to speak, to make this transition?
Well, if you go to my website, www.survivingpeakoil.com, and click on the library link, there is a library on that website of books about everything from organic gardening to passive solar building, to herbal medicine, you name it. We've got it on that website, just about anything you need for self-sufficiency, so far as information is concerned. We have links for each of those books to Amazon.com, where you can buy them. A lot of them are out of print, but at Amazon, they are linked up with used bookstores throughout the U.S., so that you can still find these books, even though they are out of print. I would suggest that people start reading up on this sort of thing. Another good source is the Mother Earth News magazine. Start looking at how you can become self-sufficient at doing more with less.
I read, I believe, Michael Rupert's article. He even sees that college could be out of reach, except maybe, you know, education could be focused more on a local level also.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, college is already becoming that. You know, with what Bush and Congress have done to the Pell Grants, fewer and fewer people who need the money are finding it available, which is unfortunate because with our standard of living in this country, everyone in this country should have the right to a free college education. And we could do it if we just cut a couple billion out of our military budget.
Oh, we have another caller, too. And this is Lee, who sat in with me on the interview with Shell. And he's also got an interview coming up Monday, which I hope he mentions, with Richard Heinberg. Lee?
Hi, Dale. Thanks a lot for all your work.
Well, thank you very much.
I'd just like to make the comment that we were talking about things that we can do. In my thinking about this, I mean, there's all the things that you mentioned, but also what I've noticed is and thought about is how important it is that we all start talking about this with our neighbors and our friends and our family and just informing people, because I really don't think we can look to the government at all. I don't think we can look to the corporate media. We can look to community radio stations that are responsive, like WGDR. I feel like the message, this people are really ready for this conversation, and it doesn't take much to start it. Up here in Cabot, we have a group of people that's starting to talk about peak oil and what we can do to respond, and people are just hungry for this because I think they feel like, you know, the wool's been pulled over their eyes for a long time, and when you start pulling it off, they just jerk it off. You know, they're ready. Hey, I just wanted to mention that.
Lee, how, I mean, you're familiar, like you said, you're talking with people in Cabot. How well positioned do you think Vermont is in comparison with, say, some mm-hmm. other states to adapt to a world where fossil fuels are diminishing in supply?
Well, we have small we still have some small villages where the farms come up to the edge of the villages to some degree. We have a lot of experience with sustainable agriculture. We have a fairly responsive government. We still have, thanks to the work of Jim Hoag, we still have an electoral system that isn't totally been bought up. It still functions to some degree. We have paper ballots. I think we have a lot going for us. I still think we can't underestimate the severity and the hugeness of this problem. And I mean, all our tractors still work on diesel fuel, and we got to start thinking about how that's going to be, how we're going to start, how we're going to deal with that as things get more expensive. And the whole discussion about debt, and I mean, there are a lot of people in this state that are in a lot of debt, and I think that's it. Just gets back to community and how much people are willing to, you know, I just go back to that. Meet your neighbors, talk to your neighbors about this, see what you can do. Look at From the Wilderness, look at the work of Catherine Austin Fitz. Jim Hoag's a great, you know, resource. Community currencies. Just start talking about all these things and don't give up. You know, the Cubans have a great saying. It's si se puede. It means it can be done. So I think that's sort of our only choice, is to stay optimistic and see what we can do and stay fascinated.
And I know that the documentary The End of Suburbia has been making the rounds around the state of Vermont and many local viewings, which maybe will raise awareness and could possibly have discussions in local communities around Vermont on the issue with that as a background.
He had a lot of very good comments there. I have noticed from my own personal experience, largely here in Michigan but elsewhere as well, that up until this past year, when I would bring up the subject of peak oil with others, either in a formal setting or an informal setting, I was met with a lot of denial and a lot of resistance. But just within this past year, the denial seems to be breaking. Probably, I'm sure it's because of the price of gasoline. It's starting to bring it home. People still, by and large, aren't aware of the full impact this will have on society. Generally, when you speak of it, their first impression is, well, it's going to be more expensive to drive a car. They don't realize that there's an expense, you know, that oil is used in just about everything in our society, from the production of metals to the production of plastics to the production of medicines, agriculture, you name it.
I think we have another caller. Steve?
Yeah.
All right, we have Steve on the air.
Yeah, this is an interesting conversation, and there's a part of it that there's a piece that I think belongs in these discussions, and I seldom hear it. And we don't ever talk about our dependency on the car. We always talk about our dependency on oil. And if you could create tomorrow a way to fix it so all automobiles would just, well, the word automobile means self-moving. If they actually made something that did move itself, that didn't require any fuel and didn't pollute, they would still kill 50,000 of us a year. They would still, when we're out on the congested highways, bring out the worst of our personalities. There's a lot of things wrong with a car, apart from the fact that it pollutes and takes up an awful lot of real estate for parking lots and interstate highways. And I wondered if we just thought in a different point of view, you know, if we could get ourselves away from the advertising campaigns that make them look like such wonderful creations, and think about what it'd be like to have a large portion of the inner part of every city automobile-free. A place where you can, that's an inviting place to live. I mean, there's a lot of people who live in cities and like it there, and we could create more of that. And they wouldn't need a car. They wouldn't even need mass transit to get to work, because a lot of them could walk to a place just a short distance away where they worked, or they could walk a short distance to a bus or train terminal that would take them to work. And the same could happen, you know, on trains and buses. They don't have to be seats with everybody facing forward, they could have a dining car on a commuter train where you could sit for a half an hour and have a coffee and donut and chat with other people you commute with rather than being isolated in your own rig every day driving, as we do here in Vermont, half 6 months of the year on roads that are so treacherous that we risk our lives driving on them. To me, it's beyond the fuel and the peak oil thing. It's way beyond that. It's about changing our whole culture to something that's more community-oriented in all aspects and getting out of these damn things that a friend of mine refers to as tin prostitutes. By that, he means cars.
Some years ago, I've traveled around the country a good deal, both by automobile, and some years ago, I traveled around the country extensively by bicycle. And in contrasting the two, the bicycle traveling was much more enjoyable, and not only that, but I was able to socialize with people in all the areas that I traveled through. When you drive a car, cars are agents of atomization. We're put into a vehicle where we're isolated from the rest of the environment around us and from everyone else. We're put into competition with the other drivers for road space, and we're also tied to that road. You know, you can't travel where there isn't a road. I've never been a big fan of automobiles.
I mentioned at the very beginning that not only is Mr. Pfeiffer a geologist and a science journalist and a contributing editor to From the Wilderness, but he's also a novelist and a poet. So if you want to tell the folks about that, about your new novel and some of your other writings and how they can get a hold of them.
Okay. Well, my latest novel is titled Giants in Their Steps. It's about, well, it takes place, oh, at some point in our future, not too distant future, but oh, at least 50 years off from now. It's about a man who falls afoul of our legal system in North America and winds up being deported to a work camp in the Canadian Rockies. Unfortunately, due to problems with the funding of these camps and the size of the prison population, the indentured servants who are being shipped there, the camp officials or prison officials take to just dumping a lot of prisoners in the wilderness area up in the Canadian Rockies and northern Alaska and the Yukon, the Northwest Territories, dumping them from helicopters with nothing more than the clothes on their back, and most of them become food for the local animals, the local wildlife. The main character in the story, Alec, he manages to survive that. He is rescued by a local mountain man, if you will, who teaches him how to live with nature. He winds up becoming quite attached to the local community, and in the course of the novel, it develops a conflict between the local community, that is the mountain folk and native people, Indians, who are still residing in the area, a conflict between them, the convict population, which takes to preying on them, and the government forces. And the entire novel is involved in the conflict of those three agencies. And talks a good deal about what we are missing in our current civilization and about the true vitality of nature and the wilderness, and has a very cautionary note at the ending. I originally began working on that novel about the time that Reagan was elected president, so I've been working on it for a long time. You can get that book along with all my other books through the publisher, www.lulu.com, or you can purchase them from Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, or you can order them through bookstores anywhere.
I saw on your website as the offer for a signed copy if they communicate with you through your P.O. box still open?
Yes.
All right. Well, yes. I'll give the address out. The address is Dale Allen Pfeiffer, P-F-E-I-F-F-E-R. It's P.O. Box 892, Clarkston, C-L-A-R-K-S-T-O-N, Michigan, U.S. Zip code is 48347. Is that all still correct?
Yeah, 48347. Yeah.
Great.
I'm glad you've got that because I didn't have that information in front of me.
So that would be, you can get the End of the Oil Age, you can get Giants in Their Steps, and I believe you have a couple books of poetry, one collected poems and the other, which sounds pretty interesting, A Primer for Existence in the 21st Century. What exactly is that about?
Well, the title was kind of a joke title.
Okay.
That's actually a pamphlet that I published back in the year 1990, and I wasn't even aware of how soon peak oil was creeping up on us at that time. The title was kind of a joke title.
Turned out to be much more relevant than you expected, huh?
Unfortunately.
So it sounds like your novel and your nonfiction writing kind of have a close connection, the importance of community and getting along with other folks.
Yes, they've always been important themes to me throughout my life, along with the value of nature and the wilderness.
And so your website is www.survivingpeakoil.com. Thank you very much for joining us here today. This is a topic that touches everything, like you said, and a lot of people notice it when it hits their price at the pump, but it's connected to nearly every one of our geopolitical moves and most of our domestic policy moves, and it's going to really be an interesting situation, at the least, with how we're going to adjust from an economy that we just created, this new global economy that doesn't seem to be compatible with the fossil fuel supplies. So thank you for joining us. And like I said, Lee Blackwell will have an interview with Richard Heinberg on WGR here at 11 a.m. on Monday. Thanks again to Dale Allen Pfeiffer.
And thank you for having me on.
We'll be right back.